Okay. Last time I talked about mean value theorems and their applications. And I focused on the connection of mean value theorems with zeros, zeros of the zeta function in particular. And the connection was through Littlewood's lemma. The applications you saw were to showing that zeros of the zeta function cluster around the critical line, then that there are lots of zeros on the critical line. That was Levinson's method. And then I showed you how a discrete mean value theorem, the sort of thing that Chris was talking about yesterday, or the day before, how those allow you to say something about simple zeros of the zeta function. Today I'm going to talk more about mean value theorems. The moral of all of this, from Chris's talk, David Farmer's talk, is that the mean value theorems are workhorses of analytic number theory. They're the Clivesdales of the subject. They do the heavy lifting. And I don't think I emphasized this as much as I could have last time. When I sketched Levinson's method, that takes about 4, 5, or 6 pages in his paper. And the rest of the 30 or 40 pages of the paper are devoted to all the technical work in computing the mean values. So those are really the guts of the work, and that's true in many, many, many problems. So last time David told you about mean values of Dirichlet polynomials, and one of the applications was to show you how to compute the mean square of the zeta function on the half-line. The basic idea was, you know, a mean value theorem for a Dirichlet polynomial, the zeta function can be approximated as essentially the sum of two pieces that are more or less Dirichlet polynomials, and you know how to handle those. All right, so we're going to continue along that theme, and I hope this is okay. I'm going to repeat some of the things that David showed you, but it's school, so maybe that's not such a bad idea. Okay, so to begin with, remember that a Dirichlet polynomial is a finite Dirichlet series, and the length, the number of terms, is what we call the length, and that I'll denote as n usually. The classical theorem on the subject says that the mean square of a Dirichlet polynomial, when I say mean square, what I mean is mean modulus, the mean of the modulus squared, but I'll say mean square. That says that the mean square is t plus an error term, n log n, so it's more or less n, times the sum of the mod squares of the coefficients of the original polynomial. That's the classical theorem. It's kind of straightforward. In fact, David showed you how that proof goes. I'll go through it again quickly. And the refined version of that, essentially the best possible form of it in some sense, is due to Montgomery and Vaughan. And that reduces the error term. The error term now depends on little n, so the error term goes inside the summation. And it's t plus big O of little n. It doesn't seem like much of a refinement, but it's really a very, very nice and about the best you can do. By the way, that was the culmination that came out of work on the large sieve. It was in that circle of ideas. And the large sieve isn't studied much these days, I guess, but back in the 70s, that was a really important, and 60s, really important and beautiful area. And everyone needs to know that stuff in analytic number theory. So you might want to look at a paper in the bulletin of the American Math Society by Hugh Montgomery called The Analytic Principle of the Large Sieve. And that gives you a good exposition of the most important work in the subject. Okay, now, let's see. Let me okay. So, looking at let's take Montgomery and Vaughan's form of the mean value theorem. I'll point out something that David pointed out, namely that if capital N, the length of polynomial, is little o of t, the length of the range of integration, then you get an asymptotic expression. But if the length of the polynomial is bigger than t, you might not. All you get are these O terms. The O terms are big O of capital N, and so if N is very large, that might swamp the main term. Okay, so is that really there? Is that just an artifact of the method used in the proof? Well, here's an example to show that it isn't. So I'm going to take the Dirichlet polynomial of length n with coefficients plus 1, and then Montgomery and Vaughan's theorem tells us that the mean square of that is the sum 1 over n, the a n squared are 1, times t plus big O of n. And that's easy to work out. The sum 1 over n times t is t times log n plus big O of 1. And the big O of little n divided by n is big O of 1, and you have capital N of those. So that gives you a big O of capital N. Okay, now if big N is little o, well, if big N is big O of t, so less than t, then this term is going to be less than that term. And so you get an asymptotic formula of t log capital N. If N is bigger than t, like t to the 1 plus epsilon, t to the alpha bigger than 1, then you get a big O of N from that. Okay, so that's what the mean value theorem gives you. Is that really correct? Well, in this case, we actually have an explicit way to represent that Dirichlet series in terms of the zeta function. Usually it's the other way around. There's a crude form of the approximate functional equation that says zeta is the sum of the first n terms of its Dirichlet series plus a term that comes from the pole of the zeta function at 1 plus a small error term. Okay, so let's just look at this in the case where sigma is a half so that we can represent this Dirichlet series by in terms of other terms. If you put in a half plus it for s and then take the modulus square of this piece, then you get the modulus square integrated of zeta plus the pole term plus that. Okay, now if you compute the mean square of each of those terms, then they are, see, the modulus square of the zeta function on the half line, we know, is t log t. The mean square of the other piece comes out to be pi n. That's very simple. And then the error term, the n minus sigma, gives you a t over n, and that's a small term. Okay, so in a theorem like this, if you have the sum of these three terms squared, if one of the individual mean squares dominates the others, you can show that that's, in fact, the asymptotic size. So of those three terms, you can see if big N in the is, you know, so the terms are t log t, pi n, and t over n. The t over n is irrelevant. So if big N is smaller than t log t in order of magnitude, then t log t is going to be the asymptotic size of this thing. If big N is larger than t, or t log t, then the pi n term is the asymptotic size. So that error term of big O of n that we got from the Montgomery and Vaughan mean value theorem in this example really is there. So in that sense, you can't really improve that result. Still, and I think you know, in the mid 70s and through a lot of the 80s, I think the mentality of most people was, you know, the polynomial has length up to t. That's it. You know, that's an obstruction, and I think I at least never really thought about getting beyond that. But it still makes sense to ask if you can find a different formula that gives you the mean square of a Dirichlet polynomial that's longer than length t. All right. So to address that, I think we should look at the proof of the classical mean value theorem, just to see where the big O of n terms come from. So this is what David showed you last time. The mean square, you just square out and combine terms, pull the integral inside the sum. And if m is equal to n, that's the diagonal term, you're integrating, you integrate and get t. If m is not equal to n, then you get an explicit integral. It's of that form. Okay? And the diagonal terms give you the first term in the Montgomery and Vaughan mean value theorem and the classical mean value theorem. Okay. So what happens with these off-diagonal terms? Well, if we put absolute values around the term, so we lose oscillation in that term, then we have a double sum of absolute value of an am over mn to the sigma log m over n. And we can treat this in various ways. Maybe the simplest is the modulus of A times B is one-half the sum of the squares of the moduli. So if I apply that to an over n to the sigma times am over m to the sigma as my a's and b's, then I get this second line here. And then that sum is symmetric in m and n. So I can just choose one of the terms and get rid of the one-half. That's equal to the same thing. And then I split the sum apart. I have the sum over n on the outside, sum on over m on the inside. And then you have to, the whole point is now to treat the sum 1 over log m over n. If m is close to n, then you get a relatively large contribution. If m is further away from n, you get small contributions. So the next part of this shows you a way to actually handle this. I won't go through it, but the point is that you can analyze it and you get capital N log N. And that's how the classical mean value theorem is proved. You need more work to get Montgomery and Vaughan's version of this. Okay. So clearly, if you're going to get any further, you have to analyze these off-diagonal terms with more care. And so let me give you an idea of what's needed to do that. I've gotten used to this. It's a pointer. So let's see. So the terms with m and n, if you interchange m and n in a given term here, then the corresponding term is the complex conjugate. So if I restrict so that m is bigger than n, then I get twice the real part of the first line. Now, let's instead of putting absolute values around things, let's let's write M as little n plus h. Okay, and h will not be 0 because these are off-diagonal terms. Then this line becomes this. And I can rewrite that. I can factor out an n to the 2 sigma here. And this is a 1 plus h over n to the minus sigma. Okay, so that should be minus. And then I've divided n plus h by n in each place, and you get that. Okay, so what can you do with that? Well, the log 1 plus h over n, let's just focus on when h is pretty close to n, just to get a rough idea of what's going on. When h is close to n, log of 1 plus h over n is about h over n. Okay? And 1 plus h over n to the sigma is roughly 1. Right? And that should be a minus sigma, but... So if you put in h over n and 1 for those expressions over there, you get this. It's a little simpler. Okay. Now, what happens if t times h, let's say h is not only close to n, but t times h is also small relative to n. So not only is h small, but t times h is small relative to little n. Then the numerator here is about ith over n. And the ih cancels that. So this term in parentheses is about t over little n. Okay, so let's replace it by that. Now, that's not all the terms, and not all of them can be treated that way. But that's just to give you an idea of what kind of things may be necessary to analyze this. So when you do that, the resulting expression looks like that. So if you're going to estimate this precisely, you've got to understand what these coefficient correlation sums are doing. Sum an, an plus h bar, summed over n. They're weighted here, and in fact, when you really carry this out, they're weighted by more complex weights. But everything comes down to having information about sums like that. All right, so before I can state the result on what you get when you do this analysis, I have to introduce some notation or some conventions. So first, in the theorem I'm about to show you, the ans will be normalized so that they're no bigger than n to the epsilon. And the sum of the ans, which is usually something we can get hold of easily. For instance, for when the ans are 1 in the first example I showed you, sum an is x. See, am I going up to x? Yes. So the sum of the ans would be x plus big O of 1. Okay. In general, we want the sum to be some smooth function of x, and here are some things that it should obey. For instance, if m of x is x, the derivative of x would be 1. That this is clearly satisfied. And then x, this theta measures the size of the error term. If an is 1, this big O of term is big O of 1, so the theta can be taken to be 0 there. Okay, but that's, of course, a very simple case. That won't generally be true. And then we need some kind of assumption about this sum, an plus h bar. So we again assume that this has a main term that's smooth in x, that the error term is big O of x to the phi, and that this holds, moreover, for shifts h up to x to the eta. So there are three parameters you should keep in mind. There's this error term in this sum. So that's that theta. And of course, you want theta to be as small as possible, but it's the size it is. There's the phi that measures how what the error term is in this. And then there's this eta, which tells you how much uniformity you have in this, these correlation sums. Okay. Now, there's one other thing I need to show you before I show you the theorem. We saw that if n was big, the size of this, for instance, if the a's were all 1, was about n, pi n. So it's more convenient in applications to subtract off the expected size of this sum. Now, what I mean by that is, see, if you integrate, what m prime is the main term, the derivative of the main term here. So, you know, if you replace, if you do an integral, Stieltjes integral for this sum using the summatory function for the ans, the main term you get would be this, and that's what we mean by expected value. Okay, so it's just in applications, it's often this that comes up and needs to be estimated. Then, in the result I'm going to show you, I'm going to weight this. So instead of going from from 0 to t, I'm going to put in a smooth weight. The weight, you don't have to worry about the conditions, but it's essentially a characteristic function. Okay, and you can go back and forth between this weight and the integral from 0 to t. There was some talk about smoothing yesterday, a lot of talk about smoothing. And I remember, always remember a remark by Dan Goldston that God likes to count using the integers, but human beings count using smooth weights. Or is it the other way around? I think it's the other way around, isn't it? You don't remember this? No, humans count with integers, 1, 2, 3, but God counts with smooth weights. That was it. Okay, so here's the result. Okay, don't laugh. I'm afraid this is not a very appealing looking thing, but I'll point out the main features. Okay, so this is the thing we're after, and it's equal to, now this psi hat, that's a Fourier transform at zero of that weight, that's just 1, essentially. So this is the diagonal contribution that you saw in the classical theorem. This gives you, see, this is m prime of something, comma, h. So that has to do with those correlation coefficients, an, an plus h. So that's how they're accounted for. And then this term has, these are m of x was just the sum of the ans. So this term is relatively straightforward. This is where all the correlation information is. Okay. And the psi hats here are actually not too hard to take care of. So the form is not very nice, but it's still useful. Let me show you those parameters, theta, phi, and eta. First, the theta and phi come in here. This is not focused, is it? Pardon me? Where is it this thing? This? Is that better? Okay. Well, let's say sigma in S is a half, just for simplicity. Then down here, you can forget about this error term. If sigma is a half, then you have n to the 0 plus the maximum of theta and phi. Now, those regulated the size of the error terms in the sum an and the sum an, an plus h. So the better the error terms there, the smaller this exponent will be, and the larger you can take n before it hurts you. What about that other parameter, eta? Eta measured the uniformity in h of the correlation sums. The eta appears up here. So n, it has to be less than essentially t to the 1 over 1 minus eta. So if eta is close to 1, then n can be taken to a power, you know, t to a relatively large power. If eta were a half, this would say you could take n to about t squared. Okay? And, of course, what we're interested in is anything over t, or t to the 1 plus epsilon. Okay, so there is a theorem like this around. And now I want to turn to some applications. Okay. First application will be to Montgomery's function f of alpha. So I'm going to use the same notation Dan Goldstein used in his talks. Montgomery's function is defined this way. It's an even function of alpha. It's non-negative. And f of xt will be just essentially the same thing without this normalization in front. And instead of t to the alpha, you have an x. Okay, so that's the thing I'm going to work with. Montgomery's theorem says that between minus 1 and 1, f of alpha, this thing, behaves like this. It's alpha here, and there's a Dirac delta at the origin. And that's the theorem. Montgomery's conjecture says that if you go beyond 1 or minus 1, that f of alpha should level off and be 1. Okay, and that, of course, we don't know if that's true. That's what we all believe. It's kind of annoying, though, because there are other possibilities. There's something called the alternate hypothesis, or alternative hypothesis, which we haven't been able to rule out on number theory grounds. Namely, that f of alpha doesn't look like this. It's periodic with period 2, and it comes back down, you know, and it's, you get these sawteeth things. And that's a distinct possibility. Nobody believes it, but you'd think you could rule that out easily. We haven't yet. Okay, so I'm going to show you how these long mean value theorems can be used to get some information about f of alpha. So this theorem is a theorem of with Dan Goldstein, Ali Osluck, and Chip Snyder. And what we did was we found that if the generalized Riemann hypothesis is true, remember Montgomery's theorem assumes just RH, then we get a lower bound for f of alpha in a limited range to the right of 1 and minus 1, left of minus 1. And let's see. So the formula is f of alpha is at least 3 halves minus alpha. So at 1, that's a half. And then at 3 halves, it's 0. So in this range, we have a lower bound. Okay. It's not a very good lower bound, but it's the best we know so far. Okay, so how do mean value theorems come into this? Well, remember that the way Montgomery proved his theorem was he started with an explicit formula, and the explicit formula looked like this. This was in Dan's talk. So the sum over zeros is related to the to a sum over primes. And then there's an error term, which we'll just ignore. Okay. Then you take the modulus squared and integrate it from 0 to t. Okay. And when you do that, just you get 2 pi times this function. Once you know this, you know f of alpha. So, and this is a different error term, but we'll just ignore the e. Okay, so this gives you the thing you're after, and on the other hand, you're taking the mean modulus square of this Dirichlet series type thing. Okay, so if x is t to the alpha, x is measuring the length of this Dirichlet polynomial. Now, if x is t to the alpha and alpha is less than 1, then this term is not too big, and you apply the mean value theorem of Montgomery and Vaughan, and you can get the asymptotic size of this thing. Now, this is a tail of that series, a convergent tail, and the Montgomery-Vaughan mean value theorem can be modified to give you a result on that, too. I mean, if you know how to handle the first part, you know how to handle the second part. Okay. And so because you can prove those mean values, the classical mean value theorem gives you Montgomery's theorem in that range. So basically, you're looking at the diagonal in the modulus square. Okay, what happens if x is bigger than t to the alpha? Well, then you require something like a long mean value theorem. And remember in the long mean value theorem I showed you, you needed these correlation coefficient sums. So in this case, they would be for lambda n plus h. In other words, you need some results about twin primes. Okay, and we don't have any such results. We have conjectures, and using the conjectures, you get Montgomery's conjecture for what happens to the right of 1. Okay, now, so actually, it's interesting. Montgomery essentially did the stuff in our long mean value theorem, but he never spelled it out. In his paper, what he says is that if you assume twin primes plus a good error term, then and what he meant was square root of x, or x to the half plus epsilon, then you could show that f of alpha is 1 out to alpha equals 2. But it doesn't show you how to do it. And then he says, and by the way, the 2 comes from the error term of x to the half plus epsilon in the twin prime conjecture. Remember I showed you could then, if you had whatever that error term was, you could take, that's not quite right. It comes from that plus having uniformity out to h equals x to the half. I think that's it. Okay, yeah, that's right. Anyway, so he says that, and then he says, if you also assume that those error terms in the twin prime conjecture, those big O of x to the halves, cancel each other when you do various averages over them so that they behave like independent variables, random variables, then you could get the result for f of alpha out beyond 2 to an arbitrary length. Okay. I didn't understand how he did that when I first read that paper. And for many years, I didn't understand it. And I talked to people, other people, and nobody really knew exactly what he was doing that I talked to. And so part of this work came from people like Dan and me trying to understand that remark in Montgomery's paper. Let's see. By the way, about a year ago, I asked him what he meant, you know, how he carried this out. He said, "I don't remember."
About 15 years ago, I asked him the same question.
Yeah.
He said, "Well, you know everything I know."
Okay, so let's see. Okay, so I want to show you how you get this lower bound for F, what the basic ideas are. So F is given by this mean square, and I'm going to write these two pieces. So this is the initial part and then the tail as A plus A star. So star means tail. Okay, and these are not just the Dirichlet polynomials or tails. They're the tails, the polynomial minus the expected value. Okay, so what you need is the mean square of that. Okay, now I guess on a previous slide, I don't know where it is now. We don't have, see, to get a long, to apply a link, oh, here it is. To apply the long mean value theorem to get Montgomery's conjecture, you need to have a twin prime type conjecture. And we don't have that, even on GRH. However, there are some approximations to lambda, which we'll call little lambda q's. These were, I think, first studied by Roger. And there are various approximations. Dan, in one or two of his talks, talked about an approximation that was a big lambda sub q. And that's a different approximation. But we use these coefficients as an approximation to the lambda n's. Now, so how do you use that? Well, I'm going to let A sub q and A star sub q be these same expressions, except that these will be little lambda q's here. Okay? So the q's refer to the approximation. And remember, star refers to a tail. Okay, so we begin with sort of Bessel inequality argument, that is, the mean square of the modulus of anything is bigger than or equal to zero. That's our starting point. So we want the mean square of this thing, and we're going to put in the approximation, see how much they differ, in a sense. This is bigger than or equal to zero. I put in the weight. The smooth weight. And then if you square all of this stuff out and rearrange things, you get that sum of the terms, so the mean square of this part, you keep separate, and you get the inequality in this form. You get a whole bunch of terms here is less than or equal to this. Okay, and then this is essentially, I put equal, but that's not quite right. It's essentially 2 pi f of x t, the thing we're after. So this will give us, if we can estimate this stuff well, we'll get a lower bound for f. Okay, so in here, you have, this term has lambda n's, and this has lambda sub q of n's. Okay, and so does this, except these are the tails, involve the tails of the Dirichlet series, and so on. Now, one thing that happens when you take a Dirichlet polynomial and you take its tail and you take one times the conjugate of the other, the integral is going to be small. They're, you know, they're not reinforcing each other. So here, if you have an initial part times a tail, the integral doesn't contribute much. So, for example, here I have a tail with lambda n's, and I have an initial segment with the lambda q's. So that's going to be small. Let's see. I can't see here. Here's a tail plus an initial piece, so that's going to be small. Won't contribute. Okay, same thing here. And that's it. Okay, so all the others, so you want things with no stars or both stars. Okay, so those pieces are going to be small. Okay, so then you have to do, you know, things that involve a Dirichlet polynomial times its conjugate, and so on. All right, so how do you do these things when the lengths of these polynomials and tails is long? Well, the main ingredient are the correlation coefficient sums. Now, I stated the theorem for the modulus square of a Dirichlet polynomial, but you can do one Dirichlet polynomial times the conjugate of another as well. And so for this term, a cubed bar, the correlation coefficient sums look like this. You need lambda n's from there and little lambda q's for the a cubed. Okay? And similarly for the tail of such a thing. And terms like that, a cubed bar, you're going to have little lambda q's against little lambda q's. Okay, so if you have information about things like that, you can get the means for polynomials that are longer than t. Okay, now fortunately there's a result of John Friedlander and Dan Goldston that gives us just this information that we need. If you assume the generalized Riemann hypothesis and capital Q is y to the delta, y is what I'm calling the length of summation here, y to the delta, delta is between a quarter and a half, then these correlation sums that you see at the bottom of the other slide can be have a twin prime estimate. That is, these things, you can prove on GRH that these things are both the same constant, the same main term you get in the twin prime conjecture, plus a reasonable error term. And not only that, but the uniformity in H is very long. Okay, so that, so we inject, we put that material into the long mean value theorems to estimate all those the terms over there that we need. And when you optimize the delta, you choose the right delta at the end in terms of alpha, you get the result, the lower bound.
So
we
see the Venus-Simon
yes, yeah.
Some correction
what was the last thing you said? So it's the Riemann hypothesis for all the Dirichlet L functions. Yeah. Okay. Let's go to the second application now. David showed you how to compute the second moment of the zeta function on the half line. And so I want to sketch for you how you can guess the sixth and eighth moments of the zeta function using these kinds of ideas. So let me remind you of something you've seen a number of times now. Harding and Littlewood proved the asymptotic estimate T log T for the second moment. Ingham gave the fourth moment, and nothing else has been proven. No asymptotic has been proven after that. The Brian Connery and Omid Ghosh gave a sixth moment conjecture. Looks like this. This is the famous number A3, you know, the arithmetical constant, product over primes. And here's the 42. This is G3 that arose in other talks. Okay, and then using some of the ideas I just discussed, Brian and I were able to conjecture the eighth moment of the zeta function. And then, of course, John Keating and Nina Snaith, using random matrix theory, gave the conjecture for the general moment. Okay, so I'm going to sketch how the approach that Brian and I took in this work. So so the kth power of the zeta function to the right of the one line has this Euler product expansion, and you multiply this out, all the Euler factors, and you get this dkn over n to the s. When k is 2, this is usually called d of n, sum of the divisors. When k is 1, d1 of n is 1. Okay, and in general, it's some kind of binomial coefficient at prime powers. Now, that doesn't converge to the left of the one line. So it's not going to be much use in getting hold of the kth power of the zeta function. But David told you there's such a thing as an approximate functional equation. And the prototypical form of these things is this. They're the initial segment of the Dirichlet series. So now I'm in the critical strip. See, you just take a chunk of this series, and then you take chi of s to the k, which comes from the functional equation, the chi factor, times the reflected, you know, an initial chunk but reflected at 1 minus s, plus some error term. Okay? There are all kinds of versions of this thing. There's smooth versions and, you know, okay. Okay, so let's write this for short as zeta to the k is this plus an error term. And so dkn from now on will be this Dirichlet polynomial. Now, the m and the n here are tied together in these formulas. Their product has to be t over 2 pi to the k. And here's the formula for chi. We understand this pretty well. It's just a quotient of gamma factors. Okay. Now let's take s to be a half plus I t. If we do that and drop the error term, just pretend it's not important, and we take the modulus square of both sides and integrate. We'll integrate from t to 2t rather than 0 to t. Then what you get is you've got the mod square of these two terms, so that results in three terms here. And here you have the mean square of a Dirichlet polynomial plus the mean square of a Dirichlet polynomial. Chi has modulus 1 on the half line. Okay, so that's why it isn't appearing in this term. And then you have the cross term, that is this times the conjugate of that. Okay. Now, we think that the cross term should not be as big as the other terms. If n and m are equal, for instance, it shouldn't be as big. And when k is 1 or 2, that's the case. That is, for the first and second moments, it's known. That's what happens. So the first thing we did was we assumed that we could drop this cross term. And actually, it's conceivable that with other forms of the approximate functional equation, like Goods, for instance, Tony Goods, it's possible, we didn't carry it out, but it's conceivable that even for k equals 3 and 4, you might be able to, let's see, what do I mean to say? Too bad we wrote this so long ago. I can't remember. I won't say anything. It's conceivable that some of the things that I'm assuming, but I won't tell you which because I don't remember for sure. I don't want to say the wrong thing. That some of those things can be shown when k is 3 or 4. In Good's approximate functional equation, the cross term, you can set things up so the cross term doesn't even appear. It seemed reasonable that, to drop this term for a couple of reasons. All right, so the mean 2kth moment should be the sums of the squares of these two Dirichlet polynomials. And m and n, these lengths, have to be t over 2 pi to the k. Now, I've switched. Before I said m, n is little t. Over 2 pi to the k. It's plausible that it should be, that you could replace it by big T. Okay. Okay, so if m and n are both in the classical range, less than t, then that last formula is correct for k equals 1 or 2. Okay, and then here's the remark. If k is bigger than or equal to 3, these error terms in the approximate functional equation are too big to carry this out. So that's one problem. Okay. All right, so now, suppose, so what we have to do is find the mean squares of these sorts of Dirichlet polynomials. All right, so we use Montgomery and Vaughan's mean value theorem applied to our polynomial, and you get this. And the arithmetic here, that is the estimation of dkn squared sum, is straightforward in number theory. And you get a result like this for this sum. And the AK here, this is the arithmetical factor. Okay. Now, if big N is less and less than T, then let's see. The main term here is T times this sum, which is a log K square of N. The O term is, let's see, the N's cancel, so you're summing DK of N squared, and that's N log, one less log than you have here. So if n is less than t, this is the main term. This is the main term. Okay, and that gives that. All right, so if big N and big M are both less and less than t, you can carry this program out. And if they're both less than t, then, of course, mn has to be t over 2 pi to the k. That means k could be 1 or it could be 2, but not bigger. Okay, and that's good enough to get the second moment and the fourth moment. Okay, if k is bigger than or equal to 3, then the product of these two things being t cubed means at least one of m and n has to be bigger than t. So that's where long mean value theorems come in. Okay, so what do you need to compute the mean value of something like this when n is bigger than t? Well, you need these correlation sums, autocorrelation sums, dkn, dkn plus h. Well, here's another source of trouble for why we can't get the sixth or eighth moments. we know results about these when k is 2 for the regular divisor function. But when k is 3, nothing's been proven when h isn't 0. So d3n plus h, no one's ever proved what the an asymptotic for that. And to do these long mean values, we need not only a correct asymptotic, a main term, but we need a good error term. So this gives you some sense of how far away we are from a sixth moment, if you look at it this way. Okay. Fortunately, though, you can guess what the answer should be, just like you can guess in the twin prime problem what the corresponding sum, lambda n plus h, should be. You can do the same thing here, and we can say very exactly what we think this main term should be. And then we guess an error term of square root of x. Okay, and we think that this should hold for h up to square root of x rather than x. So the uniformity is kind of restricted. And I'll talk about that a little bit more in 1 second. Okay, so injecting that uniformity, additive divisor estimate in for dkn, dkn plus h, we made the conjecture that when n, the length of the polynomial, is bigger than t, then the form of this mean square is sort of what it was before, but there's another factor here that depends on the exponent here, how long n is. And this WK is this complicated thing, but it's, you know, complicated looking, but it's just binomial coefficients. Okay, and we got that by heuristic method of the circle method, heuristic approach of the a heuristic application of the circle method. Okay. Now notice that the eta here is restricted to be less than or equal to 1, which means our n is never bigger than t squared. Okay. So we have this formula that we're assuming for the 2kth moment. M and n, for this conjecture, have to be less than t squared. M times n is t to the k, so that means that k can't be bigger than 4. Okay, so it could be 3, could be 4, and in those two cases, if we put in the what the conjecture says, so here's the n, here's the m, then the conjecture says that the 2kth moment should be this, where these WKs are those complicated expressions. Okay, so let's look at the sixth moment. If you put in k equals 3, what happens? W3 turns out to be this. And you need W3 of eta times W3 of 1 minus eta. Why is that? If k is 3, you have W3 of eta and W3 of 1 minus eta. Okay, so if you add this with 1 minus eta, turns out you always get 42. All the etas cancel. And it didn't matter what eta you took between 0 and 1. So you get 42 A3 over 9 factorial times TL to the 9th. And that was the second proof of a second derivation of Brian and Omit's sixth moment conjecture. And what we really liked about this is that there's this rigidity. It's the eta, this this thing stays the same through a whole range from t to t squared. So that you can vary the lengths of the polynomials a lot and it doesn't change. That seems very convincing. Okay, and then for the eighth moment, you take k equals 4 in the formulas I had, and you get this. Now remember, eta had to be between 0 and 1. And so 2 minus eta also has to be between 0 and 1. The only time eta and 2 minus eta are between 0 and 1 are when eta is 1. So here we're forced to fix eta. And W4 of 1, that's this term, is 12,012. And so I have two of those, and that gives 24,024. All right, so that's where that came from. Okay, so last slide. This is an open problem. So this is for later this afternoon. But in this conjecture I showed you, eta has to be between 0 and 1. So that n can't be any bigger than t squared. Initially, we thought that eta could be anything. And we kept getting wrong answers for the moments. Like I got a negative sixth moment one time. we looked into that, and we never really figured out. We convinced ourselves that there was something very special arithmetically going on, and we never got to the bottom of it. What seems to, how long you take this length n in the formulas, or the eta, depends on how good this error term is in these. This is dkn, dkn plus h. Depends on the size of this error term, plus uniformity of the error terms. That is, when you take relatively straightforward sums of these things over h, these error terms cancel out. So we assumed, like you do in the twin prime conjecture, to get Montgomery's conjecture, you have to assume that the error terms are big O of x to the half plus epsilon, and that they cancel each other. So we were assuming, I was assuming, I don't know if Brian felt this way, but, your first instinct is to assume that happens here too. And you get the wrong answer if you assume that. It seems to work once if h is less than x to the half, but you can't go up to beyond that, up to x to the 1 minus epsilon, like you might initially think. So these error terms, which we've been ignoring, actually contribute main term if you take longer polynomials. So that's a very peculiar thing, and something arithmetically is going on. Maybe it has to do with the spectral structure of these divisor sums. I think that's a very interesting problem for people to get to the bottom of. Okay, I'll stop there.
I guess it would say twin primes, archigenera twin primes. Is that right, Roger? It says something about z equals zeros.
Well, the node pitches in the reverse direction, but if there's a sequence of zero, of bad zero zeros, then at least there would be some ranges of T for which the pair correlation had this alternative shape. And it would say that the, obviously it would say that the conjecture that the generalized prime fin asymptotic formula holds for the Galera curve must be false. That gives the standard shape.
Thank you.